Hello, citizens. This is Deadbug. Friend. Lover. Father. Father of many, actually. And some of them are from those godless third world countries. And I gotta support them all. Well, not the ones from the godless third world countries, because, you know, their cords can't touch me. But nevertheless, the other ones, I gotta divvy up some money sometimes. And you can help me. Sign up to my Patreon, where you get hundreds of my podcasts and three times as many of my films. And you won't be disappointed.
No siree, Bob.
And I'll also send you intimate photos when I'm drunk. So what are you waiting for? I'll see yous all over there. God bless each and every one of yous. Well, except for yous from those godless nations, which I won't mention. But your money is still good. Oh, and remember, with each 100th sign up, I'm going to buy one of my kids a pack of smokes and maybe even get them vaccinated. I thank you. At what point is an individual with a mental illness culpable for his or her own actions? And if those actions seriously injure someone or even kill them? When do we put our compassion aside and deliver justice to the friends and the family of those victims? In this episode of Diagnosis to Murder, with the help of forensic psychiatrist Dr. Shaham Das, we will attempt to answer just that. So don't go anywhere, and we'll be back in a tick.
An estimated 6.1 per 100,000 of the general world population will be murdered this year.
What makes a killer?
Is it a trait that we all share as sentient beings?
Or is it something unique
to the individual? Brought on by nurturing, inner rage, we live in a time where lies and manipulation are the dueling blades of the day, where life is cheap, a commodity. Welcome to Deadbug's Diagnosis to Murder, with your host, Deadbug, with co-host,
forensic psychiatrist,
Dr. Shaham Das.
In different parts of the world, mental illness is viewed with varying degrees of compassion. If you happen to live in Sweden, you'll receive the best care in the world. If you lose your marbles in Hong Kong, not so much. But in the last 10 years, there being a significant increase in mental illness, it's a problem that's not going to go away. There is a current case in the UK that has brought mental illness to the forefront. In a brutal attack, Valdo Calacani admitted to killing 3 people and seriously injuring 3 others. And although the attack was premeditated, he pleaded not guilty due to diminished responsibilities, as he suffers from schizophrenia. And the courts agreed, and he was found not guilty and given a sentence at a high-security mental hospital, enraging the family and the public. Is this justice? And if so, what sort of justice is it? What better way to add clarity to the subject than our good friend, forensic psychiatrist Dr. Shaham Das?
Hello, cruel world. My name is Dr. Shaham Das. I'm a consultant forensic psychiatrist based in London in the UK. So I assess mentally disordered offenders, sometimes in courts, in prisons, and in locked psychiatric units. And also I work as an expert witness, which means that I give professional evidence in courts during criminal trials, including murder trials. If you're interested in this kind of area, you should definitely go and check out my YouTube channel, A Psych for Sore Minds. I dissect a smorgasbord of topics related to criminality and mental illness and the crossover between the two.
Okay, Das, it's time for us to get into this. But before we do, let's give the viewers a little refresher on the events that took place. It was in Nottingham, England, in the early morning, when police were called to an address, where they found 2 teenagers expired. They'd been coming home from a party and they were attacked. The male had fallen first, the female had tried to go get help, knocking on the door. That's where they found her. 4 minutes later, their suspected killer had attempted to enter a home for the vulnerable, but was repelled. Having failed, he moved to Magdala Road, pulling caretaker Ian Coates from his van and killing him. Then stealing his van, he went on a rampage, trying to run down anyone that he saw, hitting and seriously injuring three. Not long afterwards, police arrested a 31-year-old West African man. But the early signs showing that the murder was planned, even phoning his brother, telling him he was going to do something bad and he should leave the country.
I will say at the outset that the sentence I'm about to pass on you will result in you being detained in a high-security hospital, very probably for the rest of your life. You were and remain dangerous.
True justice has not been served today. We do not dispute that the murderer is mentally unwell and has been for a number of years. However, the premeditated planning, the collection of lethal weapons, hiding in the shadows, and the brutality of the attacks are of an individual who knew exactly what he was doing. He knew entirely that it was wrong, but he did it anyway. It took repeated questioning from us to finally receive an answer late last Friday afternoon to the question of his outstanding warrant issued September 2022 for a vicious attack on a police officer, such a violent assault that he was tasered. To the Assistant Chief Constable, Rob Griffin, who finally released this information publicly yesterday, I say this. You have blood on your hands. If you had just done your jobs properly, there's a very good chance my beautiful boy would be alive today.
Yo, Mr. Bug, Wagwan. Always a pleasure to see you, my man. Let's get into this case. Horrific case, but I've got a lot to say about it from the perspective of a forensic psychiatrist.
Well, hopefully it can help bring some clarity to this case, because there's a lot of people in the UK, including myself, who are concerned. It has been discovered that shortly after his arrest, that Calacani was transferred to a secure hospital setting. Can you break this down into layman's terms? Would this have been an automatic process because of the nature of his crime?
So Calacani is being sent to a high secure hospital. He's being sent to Ashworth. There are four of them in the UK. Broadmoor is probably the one that's the most infamous. Ashworth itself has capacity for about 288 patients. So it's got perimeter security, which is akin to a Category B prison, even though its residents are very dangerous, so they're Category A kind of level of danger. The average kind of stay for somebody in Ashworth is about 6 years. They're not necessarily released at the end of 6 years. They might step down to a medium secure unit. I've got a feeling that this man, Calacani, is going to be staying in Ashworth for many, many more years, just because what he did was so horrific and because there's so much media attention to this. So what is this? Well, it is a hospital rather than a prison. It is locked so people can't just come and go. But, and this is the crucial bit, the focus is on therapy, rehabilitation and treatment. So people aren't there for punishment. They're there to get better. So what does that mean? For Calacani, it will be like antipsychotic medication. It will be psychology sessions or regularly. There'll be doctors, there'll be nurses. It's still like a secure environment. So for example, the furniture can't be picked up and thrown around. It's kind of designed So that you can't use anything as weapons because the people in there, by definition, are dangerous. The nursing staff and the doctors carry alarms in case they get attacked. So it is a hospital for treatment, but it is geared up to deal with violent individuals.
But I'm assuming it wasn't protocol to take him out of the prison and put him into the hospital.
So in terms of whether somebody automatically would go there, absolutely it's not. So somebody would end up in a place like Ashworth on the expert evidence of a forensic psychiatrist such as myself. In fact, two independent forensic psychiatrists have to recommend it. And I would say the threshold for getting into high secure is extremely high. So in this particular case, obviously he meets the criteria, you know, triple homicide, you can't get much more intense than that. But in other cases that I've worked in, trying to get people into medium secure units, for example, it's actually a struggle. It's really hard to get people into these hospitals simply because there's not enough beds, there's really long waiting lists. So I worked as a psychiatrist in a prison for many years, and I would see, it was a women's prison, I'd see women who have much lower levels of offending, sometimes not particularly violent, robberies, things like that, and they become psychotic after they've been sentenced in prison. And it was such a ball ache to get them into these secure units. There was month-long waiting lists. Sometimes they're really unwell. So what I'm trying to say is it's actually very difficult to get people into these secure units, and it's definitely not automatic.
Once in hospital, Calacani was assessed by three forensic psychiatrists. They all agreed the 32-year-old had been suffering from paranoid schizophrenia at the time of the attacks, which impaired his ability to exercise self-control. Can you explain why it would take three experts and where they'd get these experts from? And I assume they did this separately. And what exactly would they be looking for? And afterwards, did they discuss their findings with each other?
So as you say, three independent forensic psychiatrists gave opinions. So I've given expert opinions in many cases, some cases like this, and the number of experts needed kind of depends on the case. So if it's relatively straightforward, if it's not as high profile, if it's not murder, if it's a low-level assault, then the court will only need evidence from one forensic psychiatrist, usually for the defence. So the perpetrator's legal team sorts that out. If the Crown Prosecution Service disagrees, so if they think that the psychiatrist is being overly lenient, then they can instruct their own expert that works for the prosecution. And then the two experts go into court and they get cross-examined and they battle it out. And in a case like this, where it's so high profile, where it's got the attention of all the media in the entire country, it's not unusual to get a third opinion, a fourth opinion, even a fifth opinion, if there is a difference in diagnosis, et cetera, because the court doesn't want to look weak. It doesn't want to be open to criticism. So it's better to get more opinions. But you don't need more than three. If all three psychiatrists are saying exactly the same thing, you know, the chances of the fourth person saying a different thing is very, very low. So, yeah, it kind of depends on the particular case. And if there is disagreement between the psychiatrist, and there isn't in this case, then they get cross-examined by the opposing barrister, by the judge, and they have to... Basically, the one who can prove their argument the strongest gets to... their opinion matters, and they get to kind of win. In terms of how psychiatrists would come to a finding of diminished responsibility, they would look at all of the evidence. So it's not just about assessing Kalakane in front of you and he's saying he's hearing voices. That's not enough. You look at the medical records, you look at CCTV footage of all of his behaviour, you might speak to his psychiatrist, to his nurses, to family members, so you get as much as you possibly can.
Do we know the symptoms that Kalakane suffered on the day of the killings? And how do these symptoms affect his actions that led to this tragedy?
It's been consistently reported, not only between the forensic psychiatrist who assessed him for this court case after the killings, but Kalakane has got a long history of the same kind of symptoms. So as your viewers might know, he a year before the killings, he went to MI5 and he believed that they were controlling him. He tried to surrender to MI5. He asked them to leave him alone. So what I'm saying is, it's to me, this is really quite clear that this man had a long history of paranoid schizophrenia, had these symptoms for a long period of time. So on the day of the killings, specifically, he reported hearing voices telling him that he had to kill somebody. And he also had these paranoid delusions. He believed that if he didn't carry out this extreme violence, that something really bad would happen to him and his family. I know that's not popular me saying that, and it's easier and it's more comfortable for us to think that he was just an evil man who did it for no reason. But I think the evidence, purely following the evidence, suggests that he was clearly driven by psychotic symptoms. So another way of saying that is, I strongly believe that had Kalakane not had schizophrenia, had he not been hearing those voices, had he not had those paranoid delusions at that moment in time, I don't think he'd have carried out those killings.
Well, you're right about one thing, Das. It certainly isn't a popular opinion with the public or the family. Now tell me, can an environment have anything to do with this condition? Not the cause of it, but just exacerbating it? Being in a big city?
Yeah. So in terms of environment and schizophrenia, there is actually, as it happens, Mr. Bug, good call, a slightly higher incidence of schizophrenia in urban areas. But I don't think that's relevant in Kalakane's case, because that's just the risk or the probability of any individual getting schizophrenia. It doesn't cause relapse once somebody's already got schizophrenia, if that makes sense. There are definitely some factors that can exacerbate schizophrenia or trigger it. Drug and alcohol use is probably the one biggest factor that I see. Non-compliance with medication like antipsychotics, which is relevant in Kalakane's case. And also stress in general, any kind of trauma, stress. So I suppose you could argue that life in general is more stressful in urban areas, in inner cities, although obviously you can be stressed outside of the city.
Now, Das, let's switch gears here and talk a little bit about this diminished responsibility finding. And what is it? And how do the courts decide? Because I know there's a lot of people, including the family, and if I'm being honest here, myself, who think this is a cop-out and that this guy's getting off easy.
Yeah. Okay, so this is probably one of the most contentious elements of this case. As you say, the family are very unhappy that the courts decided on diminished responsibility. Look, I'm not going to lie to you, Mr. Bug. We're good friends. I have to tell you the truth. I'm going to say something that's quite unpopular. I genuinely think Kalakane clearly meets the criteria, the medico-legal criteria for diminished responsibility. So take away morality, take away anyone's emotions, take away the fairness. Let's just look at the criteria for diminished responsibility. Somebody has to have an abnormality of mental functioning, number one, that's caused by a recognized medical condition, number two. So he was psychotic, he had paranoid schizophrenia, that affects one of three things: either understanding their conduct. Kalakane probably did understand his conduct. Form a rational judgment. I don't think he did that. Or exhibit self-control. So I think he falls in two of those limbs, and you only need to fall in one to get a clinical diagnosis or a clinical finding of diminished responsibility. And again, I'm just making the point, I'm not talking about what's fair, I'm talking about the clinical definition. And I have to say, this is quite black and white for me. So I've assessed many other cases where it's not been that clear what the symptoms were, the diagnosis is unclear, and that's why you need different psychiatrists from different sides. But I have to say, in this case, it is relatively straightforward to me that he met the criteria.
But Das, what about if this guy's faking it? It's not hard to do. You put your shoes on the wrong feet, you leave your zipper open, throw on a Milli Vanilli t-shirt, you got some drool out of the corner of your mouth.
Look at me, I got a mental illness.
I mean, I'm sure even you can be fooled. Come on.
No, I don't think I can be fooled. Not because I'm just being arrogant and cocky, which I probably am. It's because there's a whole system in place. Firstly, as I said before, we look at all of the evidence. So it's not just somebody faking an illness then. It's years and years of psychotic symptoms like Kalakane had. We talk to their psychiatrist. We look at the witness statements. We look at the police transcripts to see if he's acting bizarrely or not. The other thing I would say is that because people don't really know what actual psychosis looks like. They do like the Hollywood version that you see on TV, and it's often really unrealistic. And also, people who fake mental illness, from my experience, and I see this quite often as an expert witness, they try and exaggerate, they try and sell that they're mentally ill, whereas somebody who's genuinely psychotic, paranoid, hearing voices, doesn't tell you. So if somebody is really trying to convince me that they're ill, then the chances are they might be putting it on or exaggerating it. Plus, on top of all of that, if you're not sure, and as I said, I think in Kalakane's case it was fairly clear, but if you're not sure, there's other sections of the Mental Health Act. So you can do a section 48, which is an interim remand section. So before the trial, the person's kept in a psychiatric hospital, potentially for months. So it's easy to fake hearing voices for 1 hour if you're sitting across a handsome chump like me, but it's much harder to fake actual paranoia and hearing voices over the space of several months when you're being watched 24 hours a day by nursing staff.
Now, Das, at the end of the day, we're friends. And I know that you're a compassionate man, but I'm going to ask you, putting yourself in the shoes of the victim's family, do you think that this is fair? And do you agree that they should have got a murder charge?
Do I think it's fair? I mean, I've already answered the question, do I think it was clinically accurate for Kalakane to get diminished responsibility? And I've already explained how, in my view, he does match the case law. If you ask me whether it's fair, that's more of a philosophical question. And the honest truth is this: I can completely understand it from the family's perspective. You know, what Kalakane did was atrocious, it was horrific, the amount of pain and suffering that he caused. And I understand, an eye for an eye, I understand why the family want him to suffer in return. But the law is there to protect people who don't have all of their facilities, whose level of responsibility is diminished. And I do think his level was diminished. I think he was driven by these psychotic symptoms. And that law, that case law, this whole system that I work in is there to protect vulnerable people. It just happens that this is such a horrific case and that most people don't sympathize with him.
I'm finding it hard to sympathize with him.
I think there might be another set of circumstances. So say, for example, I've assessed, and I've talked about her on my YouTube channel, this young lady who was 18 years old, who became completely psychotic, wasn't violent, never had a history of mental illness, and killed her three-year-old nephew because she had these psychotic symptoms. Once we removed them with years of treatment, she wasn't dangerous anymore. So I think the case law protects people like that, who are not evil or bad, but are being driven by psychotic symptoms. And I don't think it's morally fair to decide that we use that defense on some people because they seem more vulnerable, and we don't use it on other people because their crimes seem more horrific. The system's got to be in place for everybody. And I suppose I'm kind of copping out of answering it, but I think the finding was fair within the system. So I work within the system, just like a police officer has to arrest somebody if they're breaking the law. The police officer doesn't get to decide what that law is. They just know what's illegal and what they have to stop. So if you're asking me if the entire system is fair, that's really a answer for politicians and lawmakers, not for a psychiatrist.
What's this guy's future going to be like in this hospital? I mean, what's going to be his day-to-day activities?
In terms of what his life in a high secure unit, it's a bit like I was saying before, so there'll be intense treatment and the focus is on recovery. So unlike prisons, you have your, it's locked obviously, and patients have their own rooms, but unlike prison, they're not kept in their cells, they're encouraged to be out of their rooms, to be on the ward, to participate in all the different therapies. Some of that's leisure activities, going to the gym, education, psychology, medication. So that's what his life will entail. Now I'm going to say something else that's a little bit controversial. I saw the ruling and the judge said in this case that Mr. Kalakane is likely to spend the rest of his life in the secure unit. And actually, with all due respect to the judge, I don't think he can make that call. It's actually not up to that judge.
Well, I read somewhere that he can be out in 3 years.
It's up to the forensic psychiatrist that treats Kalakane in the future. And because he's on a restriction order, if that psychiatrist thinks that he's ready to have leave or ready to actually be discharged and leave the hospital permanently, or have leave outside the hospital for a short period of time. Because this guy, Kalakane, is on a restriction order, he needs to get permission from the Ministry of Justice. Now, this is the controversial bit. It is very possible that clinically, Kalakane can be made safe. Might sound controversial, but if he only committed his violence in reaction to the symptoms of schizophrenia, and if we can remove those symptoms of schizophrenia, then logically, I'm not talking about ethically or morally, logically, his risk will go down. And we know he wasn't taking his medication. So to me, that suggests that the medication might work. So another way of saying that is if he was somebody who was on medication, who had tried 4 or 5, 6 different antipsychotics, and I've seen people like that, for example, in Broadmoor, that still has psychotic symptoms, then he's treatment resistant. But if he wasn't on medication, then it's more than feasible that medication could actually take away his symptoms. And again, I'm talking purely clinically. I'm talking about treating violence. So here's an analogy, right? If you had somebody who had a heart attack and they went to a cardiac ward and you put a stent in their heart and now the risk of them having another heart attack is massively decreased and they're safe to be discharged, you would discharge them. You would get them to leave hospital because there's no logical reason for them to be in hospital and it's blocking a bed for somebody else that might need urgent treatment. So likewise, if the forensic psychiatrist and the systems in Ashworth can decrease his risk by treating all of his symptoms, then at that point, he's safe to be discharged clinically. However, politically, because he's such a high profile case and because the public and the press are baying for punishment and baying for blood, I think it's very possible that the Ministry of Justice, who have to okay any discharge, might just refuse. They might say, no, he's never getting discharged. I think it's actually more likely that in 20 or 30 years' time, the public won't feel as strongly. You and I, if we're still alive, will probably remember it, but I don't think it will be as raw and as fresh. And so I don't think there will be as much of an outcry if he is eventually discharged. And I suppose some of you watching this will probably be saying, you know, he doesn't deserve to ever be released from hospital. He should stay there forever. And I totally get that. But my counter argument would be he's taking up a place in that hospital. And as I said before, it's really hard to get people into that kind of hospital for somebody who could be rehabilitated and who could be released. So that's another kind of complicated ethical barrier.
My remedy to that would be to build more mental hospitals. But I guess I'm just goofy that way. Sentencing-wise, with that degree of a mental illness, was his sentence the only option?
So he could have, instead of going to prison for a full life term, meaning he'd never be released, he could have had what is called a hybrid order. So he could have gone to hospital first for treatment for whatever, 5, 10, 20 years, and then when he's well enough, he goes to prison for the rest of his life. Now, that's not possible because he's already on a particular section of the Mental Health Act, the hospital order with the restriction, and just by law, as it stands now, you can't, if somebody's already on that kind of order, they can't end up in prison. But had he been sentenced with a hybrid order, that would have been a possibility. And I suppose you could say that would have been quite reasonable.
But Das, this guy's been committed 4 times before and has a history of refusing to take his medication. Doesn't this make a mockery of the diminished responsibility claim?
Yeah. Well, look, patients not taking their medication is very, very common, and it's a huge kind of issue problem for psychiatrists such as myself, particularly forensic psychiatrists such as myself who deal with criminals and violent people. And that's because often these people don't have insight. So to them, they believe what they're feeling. They actually hear that voice like a real voice. They have this paranoid idea as a real true belief. So they don't understand that they're ill. So that's one reason. Number two reason is the nasty side effects. So antipsychotics, medications like what Kalakane would have been prescribed, horrible. They make you put on weight. They can make you dribbling Rex, I think was the terminology that you used in an earlier question, Deadbug. They can make you sedated. They can give you movement disorders. They can give you diabetes. They can increase your risk of actually having a heart attack through cardiac arrhythmias. So I suppose what I'm saying is there's reasons why an individual might refuse to take their medication. As to whether Kalikane made a mockery of the system of diminished responsibility, I assume that when he wasn't taking his medications, he didn't know or understand or believe or appreciate that his symptoms would escalate to the degree that he would cause such a level of violence as killing multiple people. And I'm saying that because the average person doesn't want to spend the rest of their life in a hospital. So I assume, and that's not to minimise what he did, which as I said was horrific, but I don't think he meant to have done that months or weeks before he did it. So I don't think he was intentionally taking the piss out of the system. Now, some of you watching this are probably thinking, well, I don't care about Kalikane's rights or his side effects. You know, what he did was so horrific that he should have taken, there's no excuse, he should have taken his medication. And I would agree with you, knowing what we knew about him now, knowing that he went on to kill people. But let's say a year ago when he wasn't taking his medication, let's put it this way, for every one Kalikane who doesn't take medication and goes on to commit that level of violence, there's hundreds, maybe 100, 200 other psychiatric patients who have symptoms but don't go on to commit violence. So there's an ethical kind of issue about whether you force medication for those people. And again, he didn't know a year ago, he didn't know that Kalikane would do what he did. He's just one of many other people, psychiatric patients in the same boat. And I think people will be polarized about this, but I think at least some people will say that it's not fair to medicate people against their will who are not seemingly dangerous with medications that can literally end their lives or shorten their lives, I should say.
As we know, there's going to be an inquiry into the mental health services that treated Kalikane. What will this likely reveal?
Okay, again, what I'm about to say I think is slightly controversial. It would have been comforting maybe for me to answer this question by saying that Kalikane's care had loads of gaps in the system and that the mental health staff were massively mismanaged him and therefore this won't happen again or shouldn't happen again or doesn't happen on a day-to-day basis. Sorry to say this, guys, but that's actually not true. There were some shortcomings in his healthcare, which I'll get onto, but this kind of level of risk is very, very common. And again, I have to make this point. Knowing what we know about him now, myself, you, everybody who's, you know, got a brain cell in their head knows that he's dangerous now. But a year ago, I don't think people realized he didn't telegraph his level of danger. He wasn't violent for the first two or three admissions. He was violent on one of his last admissions because he assaulted a police officer. But, and this is the shocking bit, that level of violence is typical, is normal within the patients that I see. So another way of saying that is, say if we knew, say there's like an 18-year-old school shooter who does this mass shooting at school, right? Everybody will say, well, you know, you'd arrest him now, rightfully so. Why didn't you arrest him when he was 16 years old? Well, because at 16 years old, there was no signs to suggest that he would go out and kill and do a school massacre. He was a bit of a moody teenage goth and he was bullied. But you know what? So were 40 other kids in his year. So my point is that I don't think Kalikane showed a risk profile. So he did slip through the cracks. I'm not saying that his treatment was perfect because it wasn't. But I don't think he was seen as high risk. You might think that I'm being a bit melodramatic, but I can honestly tell you, Deadbug, and your viewers this. I work in two criminal courts as a psychiatrist, and this level of violence, somebody that's come in after an assault on a police officer, is very, very common. I would say that it's probably about 10 odd people that come through my courts on a weekly basis that have that kind of level of low-level violence, who've got severe mental illnesses, who are kind of lost in the system. That's every week, so I'm talking like hundreds every year. I do think that there were gaps in the system, so the very fact that he got readmitted so quickly, so many times, to me suggests that he wasn't fully well. One of two things: either he was fully well at the point of discharge, in which case there's not really that much else the mental health system can do. They can't keep him in against his will if he's not actually got symptoms at the time of discharge, and then he got ill afterwards after he left. So because he wasn't taking his medication, that's one possibility, and they should have been more of an impetus to make him take his medication, for example giving him injections of depot antipsychotics that stay in his system for longer rather than tablets that only stay in for about 12 hours or so in the system, or alternatively he still did have symptoms when he left. I can't make a judgment call on that because I've not seen the medical notes, but if that's the case, then yeah, there was a shortcoming in the system. The other thing is that there was a warrant out for Kalikane's arrest about 9 months before the killing, so it's very arguable that if the police had arrested him on that warrant, then he might not have been walking the streets at the time. Although the warrant was actually assault on the police officer, he might not have served any prison time anyway, so that might not have made a difference.
The Attorney General is set to review this heavily criticized sentence. You think they're going to throw it out to us?
So you're asking me, Deadbug, to predict the future here. Naughty, naughty Deadbug. I can't give you a straight answer. The reason being is because it depends whether it's reviewed politically or whether it's reviewed clinically. I think if a case reviews the sentence purely clinically, so as I said before, on the medico-legal criteria, on the case law, I am 1,000% convinced they're going to find diminished responsibility. I don't mean to sound crass, and I don't mean to minimise what he did, but this is textbook criteria for diminished responsibility. I have no doubt about that. However, politically, they might overrule the turning. So not because they're actually obeying the law, but because of the public outcry, because of the pain of the family, because everybody wants answers, because everybody will feel safer if they think that somebody like this can't get away with something like he'd done, although I'd argue didn't get away with it if you went to hospital. Politically, it's very possible for them to overturn the ruling. And that might sound paranoid, conspiracy, far-fetched, but it actually happens. So an example that jumps to my mind immediately is Anders Breivik, you know, the guy who killed out the massacre in Norway. He was seen by a forensic psychiatrist. They initially came up, I think, believe three of them came up with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, saying that he wasn't fully in control of his actions. The court didn't like that. They quashed it and they got another couple of psychiatrists until they got the answer that they wanted. So it does happen that politically, not clinically, things can change.
Well, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see, eh, Das?
Yo, Deadbug. Always a pleasure to be on your show, my man. I would love for some of your viewers to check out my videos on my YouTube channel, A Sight for Sore Minds. It's a smorgasbord of content related to mental illness and offending, crossover between the two. I've done loads of videos on Cala Carne. I've done a recent video on my 5 top tips if you're being stalked, how to deal with it. I've done a video on Joe Rogan. He talked about his view on why some women fall in love with serial killers, and I've got a lot of insight into that. So I've critiqued him and said what I think he got right and what I think he got wrong. Go chiggity chiggity check it out. And I shall see you guys there. Peace.
Always a pleasure, my friend. And thank you once again for adding your invaluable insight to the topics of the day. I can thoroughly recommend Daz's channel. Go check it out. I'll leave a link in the description. And I'll see you all next time on Diagnosis to Murder.